a vinyl experience with me, Paul Cavalcante, Friday afternoons at 5 p.m. Eastern and anytime in the archives at PRN.FM.
It's just the normal noises in here.
Custom mixed for the Progressive Radio Network, the progression of recorded sound from the Edison cylinder to the 180-gram super vinyl albums of the 21st century. Vinyl is in, and I give it a spin on the vinyl experience at PRN.FM.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative. It's progressive, the truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, we have a packed show. We're going to begin, of course, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing. For those of you who are going to get a flu shot to protect you from the flu, well, you might want to think twice. I have an in-depth, definitive article on the safety and efficacy of the flu shot coming up in the next few days. But a new study shows that colostrum is 300% more effective than the flu vaccine with no downside. We'll share that with you. Also, turmeric heals spinal cord injuries better than drugs and surgery, according to the latest journal, Neurology Research International. And then we're going to look at cranberries disrupting harmful bacteria's ability to communicate and spread and become virulent, McGill University. And we're also going to take a look at how red wine and the compound resveratrol can reset infertility hormones so you can become fertile, University of California, and much more on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program today is Dr. Ken Stoller. I've had many people say, Gary, could you do something on Lyme's disease? Sure will. Today, Lyme's disease is so widespread, but why have the federal health agencies and the medical establishment ignored it? What's behind this denial? And what is the way that I approach Lyme's disease to help people get back to living a normal life? Also today, a special commentary from Professor Henry Giro, The United States War on Youth, From Schools to Debtors' Prisons. We'll share that as well. And from our audio files, a very unusual discussion where one of Europe's best investigative journalists questions Syria's Assad. And it's a longer interview. I've only taken the first 10 minutes. And I want you to hear what he has to say. Then do your own homework to determine, is he honest? Is he objective? Compare what he says and the evidence that is readily available to what the New York Times, CNN, the Wall Street Journal, the entire Democratic establishment, and the Republican establishment are all saying about Assad in Syria. They all believe he should go. They believe that he was killing hundreds of thousands of his people. They believe that he is evil. Is it true? Then I will follow up with a discussion about the latest, greatest heroes coming out of Syria, and that's the White Helmets. Are they really heroes? Are they really doing the right thing for people? Are they just another propaganda tool? Also today, a different conversation, not one that is government or industry supported, about oil is life, the pro-oil position out of the Dakota pipeline. So we'll have a different person giving a different perspective. And also from the Young Turks today, why a third-party vote is not a wasted vote in this election. So we'll cover all these, and if time permits, we'll end with Bertrand Russell, one of the greatest philosophers in history's advice for future generations given back in the 1940s. So let's begin. If someone has a really seriously impacted immune system, let's say you're suffering from AIDS-defining illnesses, I work with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS, high levels of viral infection, and that for over 10 years, every day, 7 days a week, we were open, from early in the morning, 8 in the morning, till midnight, helping people. And one of the very first things to do is to build up their natural immune system, because their immune system had substantially collapsed. Colostrum, in a drink with other botanicals and homeopaths, were always what would be the beginning stage. Later would come the intravenous vitamin drips, but the colostrum was always important. Now, normally, if a person is allergic to dairy, I would say don't have colostrum. But in this case, their systems really rebounded. In fact, so much so that after a period of 3 years, I produced my first documentary on AIDS called AIDS: The Real Heroes, which chronicles the life of 20 individuals who had full-blown AIDS and made very healthy recoveries. And in fact, I'm going to be posting that so you can hear their stories and see what they did. But this isn't about AIDS now. This is about flu. But the ingredient is the same, colostrum, C-O-L-O-S-T-R-U-M. According to Dr. Jeffrey Dash, medical doctor, publishing in Green Med Info, very good quality source for health information, studies show the colostrum is nature's safe and healthy answer to the lethality and danger of man-made vaccines. Dr. Maria Cesarone from Italy published her study in which she compared the efficacy of the oral colostrum to that of influenza vaccination in preventing flu illnesses. She found that a 2-month treatment with oral colostrum was 300% more effective in preventing flu illness than was influenza vaccination. So, if you haven't grown up on a farm, you probably don't know what colostrum is. Colostrum is the first 24 to 48 hours of milk produced by the cow after the calf is born, and it contains an enormous important immune system and growth factors needed for the calf. If the calf does not receive mother's colostrum within 24 to 48 hours after birth, the calf will die. Bovine colostrum is similar to human colostrum, breast milk, and the richest breast milk is the breast milk in the first 48 hours, and that's why a baby should never be separated from the mother, should be immediately given to the mother so the mother can begin breastfeeding. Because remember, the baby has no immune system. Well, there's another model to support this, and it was a Dr. Wong who in a colostrum study showed it stimulates immune system. Quote from this study, colostrum supplementation enhanced natural killer cell cytotoxicity and improved the immune response to primary influenza virus infection in mice. Quote, colostrum supplementation demonstrated less reduction in body weight after influenza infection, indicating a less severe infection, increased natural killer cell cytotoxicity, and less viral burden in the lungs compared with controls. In lay language, the natural killer cells have to be activated. It's not about creating more. It's about having the ones that exist become more potent immune fighters, and it's your natural killer cells that identify and kill cancer cells circulating in the blood. But in this case, it was able to kill the influenza virus and have less burden upon the lungs in the process. So we're not talking about a huge amount of colostrum is necessary, but it's the source of the polyclonal antibodies. So that's very important. That's something new. So for those of you who would like a natural, non-toxic, and substantially proven with multiple studies, then at least you have something now instead of the vaccine. Another thing that is natural that can help our body is turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C. According to the latest research, and this was in Neurology Research Information, quote, the article is entitled The Potential of Curcumin, which is the active ingredient in turmeric, in treatment of spinal cord injury. And it suggests that this ancient herbal spice, turmeric, and its primary polyphenol, curcumin, may provide victims of spinal cord injury a safer, more effective approach than conventional treatment, which relies primarily on surgery and corticosteroids. And if you've ever taken those, you blow up like a balloon. And it also just destroys your immune system. They're very powerful anti-inflammatory drugs. They're notorious because of their side effects. Whereas curcumin has been validated in thousands of studies to have immense value in treating a wide range of inflammatory-based diseases. In fact, more than 100 diseases are known to be beneficially affected using turmeric or curcumin. So, despite this wealth of already published research demonstrating curcumin's powerful anti-inflammatory properties, we're not using it in the United States. And we should. But if you were to go to India, medical doctors in India, including at their leading hospitals, they're way up on Ayurveda and curcumin. And another thing that we don't use, and we should, is cranberries. Now, if you want to get something really powerful, you can buy fresh in season or frozen organic cranberries and blend them. Add in some apple juice. Add in a teaspoon of Manuka honey, and you have a very powerful control for bacteria buildup in the urethra or your bladder. So for bladder infections, urethral infections, they're real whole pure. Now, it's really bitter. That's why a little Manuka honey. And then the apple juice also has similar qualities, and they're synergistically together. And then if you really want to make it super duper, add in about 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams, depending upon bowel tolerance, of a buffered vitamin C. Now, scientists at McGill University and the Armand Frappier Research Center in Canada, they did an investigation on cranberry extract, and they found that it interrupts the communication between bacteria that are the cause of pervasive infections. And they published this in Nature Science Reports, which is a highly respected publication. So in lay language, what it does is the cranberry disrupts the communications and as a result, flushes it out of the body. So that's why once you have an infection, bladder infection, you take a 16-ounce glass of cranberry juice in the same proportion I just mentioned. Then follow it an hour later with vitamin C and lemon juice with apple cider vinegar, a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, a tablespoon of lemon juice, and 16 ounces of water with some vitamin C. And that then further kills any remaining bacteria. So it's a 1-2 punch. First comes the cranberry, then comes the lemon juice afterwards with apple cider vinegar. And then you should be well on your way to having a healthy bladder. And here's what we don't talk about, and we should. Most of these infections, urethral infections, and many bladder infections, and many infections in the vaginal area are due to improper hygiene. A lot of women may not be educated on this particular hygienic topic, irrespective of what they're educated on in other areas with high levels of competency. Wiping from the back forward takes fecal matter from the back around the anus area and puts it in a position to migrate into the vagina or into the urethra. And once in there, you're going to have an infection. even wiping correctly from front to back is not enough. Because if you were to take, what was it? It was on one of those stupid shows that were trying to debunk hygiene isn't being important. And what they did, they took some bacterial samples off toilet seats and showed that there were not a lot of bacteria on the toilet seat. Of course there's not going to be a lot of bacteria on a toilet seat. And I'm just amazed. The bacteria is on the backside of a person's legs, on a man's testicles, and on a woman's back thighs and buttock. Why? Because when you defecate and that hits the water, it backsplashes. It splashes up. And for a man, it's going to splash on the testicles first because it's the lowest point. But it's also splashing underneath the seat and on your leg. Let someone do that experiment correctly. Take a sample of a toilet seat, then take a sample of someone's exposed bottom thighs after they've been on a toilet and they flush the toilet. You'll see a massive amount of bacteria, fecal bacteria, on your legs, the legs that are exposed, and on the bottom of the toilet seat. And those, remember, bacteria migrate. They move. They travel. So the proper way to do it, if we were really civilized, if we weren't an uncivilized society, which we clearly and emphatically are when it comes to hygiene, then we would do what the Japanese have done and other cultures have done. In fact, if you even go into the common public toilets in Japan, you can set a dial on a toilet where you can have the toilet heated to what you desire. Then after you've finished, automatically sprays an antibacterial mist, and then you can have a bidet effect where warm water with soap comes up and cleanses the entire anal area. And then it dries with a blower. All this isn't even the upscale part of the home ones. This is just normal, everyday. Everyone in Japan has this concept. They just, in fact, one of the reasons I don't have a problem eating in Japanese restaurants is because the level of their hygiene, understanding, cleaning under the fingernails, washing hands repeatedly, keeping surface tops clean. You go into a regular restaurant, they take a dirty rag and they wipe your table like suddenly it's clean. No. Everything that you've wiped off every other table is now on that rag. Now you're just smearing it. It's much like taking an apple. We've all done this. I did this growing up. You take an apple and you wipe it across your blue jeans or your shirt. You haven't cleaned anything. All you've done is smear what you thought you were eliminating over everything else on the apple. You clean something by simply putting it under water, spraying it with any form of cleansing material, natural cleansing material, that will get rid of the surface grime, bacteria, and viruses. Then it's fine to eat. And because the average piece of fruit and vegetable that you're consuming has been touched by 24 separate hands, all of them dirty. So just think about that the next time you pick up some grapes or cherries and you just want to eat it right there because it looks so good. Well, you're getting a lot more than the cherries in your mouth at that point. And we just don't like to think about that, but we should. So America's phobia about not wanting to be hygienic. I don't believe that we want to be. I'll explain that why on a different program. But man, we put ourselves in these stupid positions getting infections. We shouldn't just wipe. We should wipe and wash. Proper hygiene. And that's just a radically unacceptable construct in America. Finally, red wine can reset infertility hormones. According to the University of California, resveratrol, quote, may help tackle hormone disparity in women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. and a common condition that can cause infertility. The condition provokes overproduction of testosterone, and that has been found to affect a high percentage of women of reproductive age. Other hormones, such as DHEAS, are also produced in excess. So resveratrol for women could make a big difference. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City. You can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and searching for Gary Nall. And you can download any program, listen to it over the internet, or listen to it by any portable listening device, cell phone, anything you want. I'll give you a number for the archives, and 99% of the people who are listening to this program will listen to it in the evening or at some other time from the archives. Our archives number to call is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Now, this evening, 7 p.m., on the Progressive Commentary Hour, an extraordinarily unique program. We're going to have the person on who's going to tell you in detail who controls Hillary Clinton, who controls almost every president, who is the power behind the throne. You won't know who this is. My guest will. My guest has just returned from Russia and the Vatican and other places, and will give you insights as to the lies about Russia being the great demon and we should be preparing for a nuclear war or a third world war or some form of confrontation with Russia. You'll hear the truth, but more importantly, you'll know who's behind all this. That's this evening, 7 p.m. I'm sure many of you, as have I, have been concerned about the whole idea that, in effect, we exploit youth in our society. They're a commodity. If they're poor, they can be commercialized. Or if they're wealthy, they can be commercialized. If one important measure of a democracy is how a society treats its children, especially poor youth of color, there can be little doubt that American society is failing. As the United States increasingly models its schools after prisons and subjects children to a criminal legal system marked by severe class and racial inequalities, it becomes clear that such children are no longer viewed as a social investment, but as suspects. Under a neoliberal regime, in which some children are treated as criminals and increasingly deprived of decent health care and education, food and housing, it has become crystal clear that the United States has both failed its children and democracy itself. Though I feel privileged, and I know many of you feel privileged, because we were the last generation in American history to come from a class where the middle class thrived, where we, as members of the middle class, had the benefit of our greatest generation, those of our parents that were born or raised through the Great Depression, who instilled in us a sense of character, moral principles, manners, patience, and understanding the significance of each of our contributions to the common good of others. That is lacking today, and I think we're all aware of that. Not only is the United States the only nation in the world that sentences children to life in prison without parole, the criminal legal system also functions so as to make it more difficult for younger people to escape the reach of punishment, especially in a purely racist legal system. For instance, according to a recent report published by the Juvenile Law Center, there are close to 1 million children who appear in juvenile court each year, subject to a legal system rife with racial disparities and injustices. This is made clear by Jessica Fierman, Associate Director of the Juvenile Law Center, in her report, Debtor's Prison for Kids, The High Cost of Fines and Fees in the Juvenile Justice System. Here's what she had to say, and I want to quote this, and we can thank Professor Henry Giroux for this research. Quote, "Racial disparities pervade our juvenile justice system. Our research suggests we can reduce these disparities through legislative action aimed at cost, fines, fees, and restitution. In every state, youth and families can be required to pay juvenile court costs, fees, and fines, or restitution. The costs for court-related services, including probation, a free-appointed attorney that's not free, mental health evaluations, the cost of incarceration, and treatment or restitution payments can push poor children deeper into the system and families deeper into debt. Youth cannot afford to pay for their freedom, often face serious consequences, including incarceration, extended probation, or denial of treatment. They are unfairly penalized for being poor. Many families either go into debt trying to pay these costs or forgo basic necessities like groceries to keep up the payments. According to the report, sometimes when a family cannot pay court fees and fines, their child is put into a juvenile detention facility. Such punishment measures are invoked without any degree of conscious or informed judgment, as when children are fined for being late, for being truant from school." By the way, there's an article in Common Dreams by Makita Wright points to one case, this is just one case, in which a child was fined $500. $500 for being truant. And because the child came from a poor family, they couldn't pay the fine. Quote, "So this child, for just being truant, committing no crime, spent 3 months in a locked facility as a young man." Could you imagine that? In many states, the parents are also incarcerated if they can't pay for their child's court fees. For many parents, such fines represent a crushing financial burden which they cannot meet, and consequently, their children are subjected to the harsh confines of juvenile detention centers. There's one case of a Dequan Jackson, had his only brush with the law. He was just 13 years old, and he was trying to do everything right. He was actually charged with battery. Why? Was he in a fight? No. He was simply playing with a kid in a hallway, turned around, and actually bumped into a teacher. That's all. No harm done. Said he's sorry. But the teacher wouldn't let it go. Brought in security, which is the police. He was forced to plead guilty with a promise that after 1 year of successful probation, the conviction would be reduced to a misdemeanor. He worked 40 hours in a food bank. He met with an anger management counselor that was required. Though he wasn't angry, had no history of violence, he had never done anything wrong in his life. And he kept to an 8 p.m. curfew, except when he was returning from church, and he wasn't in any trouble whatsoever. But he and his mother, who is struggling to raise two sons on a very small income, were unable to meet one financial condition, paying the court $200. for a public defender's fee. But hold on, aren't public defenders supposed to be free? They're supposed to be, but in the debtor's prisons, they're not. As a result, they didn't have the $200. For that reason alone, his probation was extended for another 14 months until they pulled together the money at that time when they had trouble finding quarters even for a laundromat. So let's just think of it this way. A child is simply playing, as all children do, turns around and bumps into a teacher, doesn't hurt the teacher, doesn't knock down the teacher, and now that person becomes one of our criminal justice system statistics. And then everything starts a meter where everyone's going to exploit it as much as they can. How many times have we heard that our schools have become almost like mini prisons? Suicide rates behind bars for youth, 400% higher than the regular prison system, according to Child Trends Data Bank. Moreover, between, quote, 50 and 75% of adolescents who have spent time in juvenile detention centers are incarcerated later in life. The culture in the prison system destroys people. Finally, as the Debtors Prisons for Kid report makes clear, kids are being sent to jail at increasing rates while some youth crime is decreasing. The criminal legal system is mirrored in a form of casino capitalism that not only produces wide inequalities in wealth and income and power, but also corrupts municipal court systems that are underfunded and turn into unethical and corrupt practices in order to raise money, while creating new paths to prison, especially for children. The reality is that in the United States today, every one of our past four presidents, and clearly will be Hillary Clinton, all support debtors' prisons. They all support incarceration of people of color. They all support the incarceration of blacks and Latinos. They all support the war on drugs. They support one arrest every 26 seconds, most of marijuana. They support putting a person who possesses marijuana in prison for 7 years or longer. Why? Weren't these good Democrats? Weren't these good liberals? Are these the same people, Michael Moore, who claims to be a liberal, who's done good movies on being a liberal, is now supporting an absolutely class act fascist neoliberal Hillary Clinton? To me, there's a contradiction there, because I know of no true progressive or true liberal that would want to support neo-fascism, neoliberalism, or this one-world mindset, and certainly not support the private prison system. Oh, I forgot, unless they took money from it, or unless those two main private prison systems give large money to your foundation or invite you to be a speaker, then suddenly you're all for filling beds. We are now making normal behavior into criminal behavior if you're a person who is poor. So all of our schools now, in part, are being considered, even though not stated to the public, as schools modeled after prisons. We live at a time in which institutions that were meant to limit human suffering and misfortune and protect young people from the excesses of the police state and the market have either weakened or have been abolished. The consequences can be seen clearly in the ongoing ruthless assault on public education, poor students, and students of color. Schools have become, in many cases, punishment factories that increasingly subject students to the type of control and discipline and surveillance that we had expect in a police state. Pedagogy has been emptied of critical content and now imposes on students mind-numbing teaching practices organized around teaching for the test. The latter constitutes both a war on the imagination and a disciplinary practice meant to criminalize the behavior of children who do not accept the conformity and the overbearing control. No longer considered democratic public spheres intended to create critical, informed, and engaged citizens, many schools now function as punishing factories, workstations that mediate between warehousing poor students of color and creating a path that will lead them into the hands of the criminal legal system and eventually prison. Under such circumstances, it becomes more difficult to reclaim a notion of public schooling in which the culture of punishment and militarization is not the culture of education. Hope in this instance has to begin with a critical discourse among teachers and students and parents and administrators unwilling to model the schools after the prison culture. There are many noble teachers. I wished I could say the same for the heads of the administrations and those who profit. Many schools are now modeled after prisons and organized around the enactment of zero tolerance policies, which, as someone who's appeared on this program, John Whitehead, has pointed out, put youth into the bullseye of police violence. The nation's public schools, extensions of the world beyond the schoolhouse gates, a world that is increasingly hostile to freedom, have become microcosms of the American police state, containing almost every aspect of the militarized, intolerant, senseless, overcriminalized, legalistic, surveillance-riddled, totalitarian landscape that plagues those of us on the outside. Not only has there been an increase in the number of police in the schools, but the behavior of kids is being criminalized in ways that legitimate what many call the school-to-prison pipeline. School discipline has been transferred into the criminal matter sphere, now handled mostly by the police rather than teachers and school administrators, especially in regard to the treatment of poor black and brown kids. But cops are doing more than arresting young people for trivial infractions. They are handcuffing them, using tasers on children, applying physical violence on youth, and playing a crucial role in getting kids suspended or expelled from school every year. The Civil Rights Project rightly argues that public schools are becoming gateways to prisons. One estimate suggests that a growing number of young people will have been arrested for minor behaviors by the time they finish high school. This is not surprising in schools that already look like a quasi-prison with their drug-sniffing dogs, surveillance systems, metal detectors, police patrolling, school corridors, and in some cases, police stations that actually are part of SWAT teams on location. And while there's been a great deal of publicity nationwide over police officers killing black people, there has been too little scrutiny regarding the use of force by police in the schools. How many are there? 17,000 police working in our school system right now. And 92,000 students a year are subjected to arrest. Wouldn't it make more sense if in every school in America we hired one or two people, depending upon the school size, the student body size, to counsel those students who are having problems? Not every student is perfect. There are bullies. There are gang members. There are some people who need to be given the type of counseling that would help them adjust bad behavior at a young age and allow them to live within a society that needs not to be distracted by violence. That is much better than bringing police into a school and then making every student believe they're suspect because of their poorness or their color. We are approaching this in the wrong way. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Going out to
Brisbane, California, to say hello to Dr. Ken Stoller, S-T-O-L-L-E-R. He's a board-certified pediatrician specializing in functional and natural medicine and also functional neurology at a clinic in San Francisco. He is also an environmental activist. He was founder and president of the International Hyperbaric Medical Association. He pioneered in hyperbaric treatments for various conditions, including fetal alcohol syndrome. And having become frustrated with medical agency and association cover-ups and the corporate medical lobby powers over the rapid rise in children's developmental disabilities, Dr. Stoller and other physicians testified before Congress on the role vaccinations have played, particularly mercury, in the rise of autism and other related conditions. And for a couple of decades, Ken has been treating stroke, autism, cerebral palsy, MS, and more recent Lyme brain disorders. He received medical degrees and training from University of California, Los Angeles, School of Medicine, and he's on the line now. Nice to have you with us today, Ken.
Thanks for having me on again, Gary.
The CDC estimates that there'll be 300,000 new cases of Lyme's disease this year. Although it first appeared in the Northeast, in the town of Lyme's, Connecticut, and right across the channel from Plum Island, by the way, which is known as a bioweapons research facility, and it is now spreading nationwide. Even California has witnessed a rapid growth in Lyme's. And yet there is much mystery to this spirochete organism-related disease, in addition to the other tick-borne pathogens that cause co-infections, that is not being addressed and certainly absent from the media. And generally, it's thought to be a minor infection treated by antibiotics. Yet there are also numerous cases of debilitating and even life-threatening conditions. In fact, over 100 symptoms from severe paralysis to mild headaches and fever. And as far as I can see, the CDC and the other health agencies are doing nothing, and I say absolutely positively nothing, to stem the rise in this epidemic. And what I hear and read, there's very little findings out there that would say what people should do outside of just taking antibiotics. So what I'd like for you to do is this. I'd like for you to tell us what is the latest on Lyme's disease, how it can be treated naturally, and why, in your opinion, are the federal agencies not addressing this in a more assertive way? The forum is yours.
Well, first, Gary, I want your listeners to know a lot of the questions you've asked are in Chapter 1 of my new book, Incurable Me, and that chapter can be read for free online on Amazon with that look inside feature. You can read the whole first chapter. So if anyone needs to go back to anything I've said and more, it's there for free online on Amazon in my book, Incurable Me. But essentially, the CDC is now admitting that there are 330,000 new cases of Lyme disease every year, which is an astonishing number because this disease goes back decades. So if you go back a few decades, and let's just say that 330,000 new cases a year number is a conservative number, you're still dealing with millions and millions of Americans who are infected with this illness. So in the face of such an incredible pandemic, and you don't have an answer for it, you pretend it's a nuisance disease, that it's not really that important. But Lyme disease is an incredibly serious illness. I mean, syphilis only has 22 genes, the organism syphilis. Lyme disease has 132 genes. It is like getting syphilis on steroids. It's a much more sophisticated organism, and it can drop you to your knees faster than, saying Rumpelstiltskin. It will give you Alzheimer's disease, and maybe 10 years from now, everyone will recognize that Alzheimer's disease is actually a neurospirochetosis, which means it's an infection of your brain with spirochetes. But it's going to take another decade before everyone figures that one out, thanks to the incompetence of the CDC. I mean, let's say you were an ethical CDC employee, and you really wanted to help people, and that might require a lot of imagination if you're a member of the infectious disease division, and and you said to the American public, hey, everybody, I just wanted to let you guys know that maybe 50 million of you are infected with an organism that's difficult to diagnose. There's no consensus on treatment. We really don't know when you've eradicated it or not. And it causes Alzheimer's disease. It can cause sudden death with Lyme myocarditis, arthritis. It can turn you into a psychotic, bipolar, depressive patient at its whim. It can do all those things. This is a serious illness. Now, granted, most of those people who have Lyme disease are asymptomatic, just like if you have tuberculosis. 90% of tuberculosis patients are asymptomatic. But boy, when you have symptoms, you have symptoms. This is a serious global pandemic. It's the medical negation of an illness. And I can tell you why, because that's one of your questions. Why is the CDC doing this? Why are they just letting this slip through their fingers? It's because the influence of Big Pharma is so incredible, and they desperately want to have a vaccine for Lyme disease because that's how they can make gobs of money. But to have a vaccine, your illness has to fit a vaccine model. And what I mean by that is that the antibodies a vaccine helps your body create must actually do something. And you can ask, why is there no vaccine for syphilis? It doesn't matter how many antibodies you have to syphilis. You're not getting rid of it unless you're taking penicillin. Well, the same thing is for Lyme disease. And the reason why Lyme disease is so difficult to get rid of is it slathers itself with this biofilm material. And you could be on the right herbs, you could be on the right antibiotics, and as long as it's in this biofilm, which is like the stuff you brush off your teeth twice a day, you can't get at it. But there's another evil part of this organism. It leaves persister cells. And these persister cells can't really be killed because they're metabolically dead. And they will wake up when they feel like waking up, and there's no way to detect them. There's no way of knowing if you have persister cells. So you may think you've cured yourself of Lyme disease, whatever method you've chosen, and it can come back 2 weeks, 2 months, 20 years later. So that's what we're up against. This is a biblical plague for more reasons than one.
Why are the standard diagnostic methods most commonly used so poor and subject to false negatives at a very high degree? And I've seen figures of up to 90% of chronic Lyme's illnesses go undetected. And then why are the better and more accurate methods available not being fast-tracked and approved by the FDA?
Well, because the government doesn't want the public to really understand what this illness is about. You're right. Almost 90% of patients can be missed by our current testing methodology. Now, we're using the Dearborn criteria, which is looking indirectly at antibody levels. And it's interesting that a decade and a half or so ago, the CDC removed the two most sensitive antibodies from the testing criteria because a pharmaceutical company says, well, we're going to use those antigens in our vaccine, so we don't want there to be confusion about, you know, diagnostic issues. So please remove band 31 and band 34, as they're called. And so the CDC removed those bands, making it even more difficult to diagnose patients. Now, there are labs in the United States that have left those bands in, and you get a much more accurate picture of whether somebody has this illness or not. But there's another problem, Gary, and that is Lyme disease is just not caused by the Burgdorferi group of Borrelia. So there's two main groups. There's the relapsing fever group, and there's the Borrelia Burgdorferi group, and there's about 18 genospecies plus or minus in each one of those groups. If you have a Borrelia infection with an organism in the relapsing fever group, you are not going to get picked up by this testing procedure. You have to actually look for the relapsing fever group of organisms. So that's why you're looking at 90% of people who fall through the cracks diagnostically. I mean, in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I'm talking to you from, 40% of the infected ticks are infected with relapsing fever group organisms, Borrelia myomotoi, as it's called. I hope I answered your question.
You did. Now let's go to the solutions. Share with us what you're able to see are the best treatments to help people recover.
Well, there are many roads to Rome, somewhat fewer to Lyme, Connecticut. And by the way, you know, you talked about Plum Island being a biological warfare facility, or at least it was. Whenever the government has a role in creating a problem, there's always a lot of obfuscation for some reason around that. And, you know, no more so than it is in Lyme disease. So there's considerable evidence that someone on Plum Island was trying to weaponize the Borrelia to use as a biological agent against the Soviet Union, because the head of this Plum Island biowarfare facility was actually a previous microbiologist SS officer whose specialty was using insects as disease vectors. Now, someone with half a brain figured out, well, gee, if we wipe out the domestic animal population in the Soviet Union, who's going to feed them? And so they nixed the idea. And maybe they got so mad on Plum Island, they just let loose all the ticks that they had. And it's not far from Plum Island, as you know, to get to Lyme, Connecticut. It's less than 10 miles. So a more virulent strain of Borrelia was unleashed on the population. And it's documented in the medical literature that there is this strange, super virulent strain of Borrelia that they can trace it to back to the last 200 years, but it's probably more like the last 60 or 50 years that this strain was unleashed on the population. So something changed. Now, I don't want people to think this is a new illness. It's not a new illness. Borrelia have been infecting humans for thousands upon thousands of years. But you don't ignore the illness. Can you imagine if everyone realized, oh, my God, 50 million Americans have untreated syphilis? Wouldn't that be a national emergency? Well, Lyme disease is worse than syphilis, and yet we're ignoring it.
Okay, Ken, we only have 4 minutes left. Please focus exclusively now on the positive solutions to help people.
Well, I've detailed this in chapter one of my book.
But detail it now, Ken. Tell us now.
Okay. All right. So I have come across an antimicrobial agent that is very well tolerated by or nitazoxanide, and it strips the biofilm from the organism, and it's the primary intervention that I use in treating Lyme patients. But as you know, I'm in the hyperbaric oxygen therapy as well, and hyperbaric oxygen, which unfortunately is not accessible to a lot of people, will kill this organism. And so you can druglessly kill this organism by raising the oxygen partial pressure in the body beyond which the organism can stand, because this organism does not like oxygen. So I think, without going into the full protocol, which will just confuse people, that those are the two kind of novel things that I have been using to help treat this illness.
Okay. I'll add some of my own, because I've worked with a lot of people with Lyme's disease successfully. First and foremost, I give them a protocol to stimulate their immune response, recolonize the bacteria, put them on a very strict diet, a high living foods diet, about 13 glasses of green juice a day, oxygenate the blood, DMG, dimethylglycine, TMG, trimethylglycine, your oxidative nutrients, also beet juice, creating better nitric oxide in the blood, along with beet greens, and then as they shift over to a plant-based, high natural oxygen diet, getting them to exercise, even though they may feel weak, sometimes even paralyzed or lacking in equilibrium, it's very common to have a side effect of they simply can't stand for long. They feel dizzy. They feel nauseous. But if they can, even doing slight things like getting on a stationary bike and just pedaling. But then I start with homeopathics. And then from there, I get them to see a physician that does ozone therapy. And in graduating up, and then you start measuring for the kill rate, and then the most important is over a period of time, they graduate up to where they're using intravenous nutrients, especially I found a glutathione push, vitamin C above 100,000 milligrams with aqueous vitamin A, and it's the combination of vitamin A with the vitamin C above 100,000. And vitamin A is normally not water-soluble, but there is an aqueous form that is. And I have found that within 3 months of implementing that protocol 3 times a week, we have seen substantial improvements, and they stay improved after that. Your thoughts, please.
Well, anything that improves the immune system will benefit this illness. So if your immune system is in top shape, you will mask this infection and keep it under wraps. One of the things that I also use is the knowledge that in 2013, Woods Hole Oceanographic discovered that the Lyme disease organism is manganese dependent. And there's an old drug, second-tier drug that's used to treat tuberculosis, 5-aminosalicylic acid. It's also used to treat people with inflammatory bowel disease. It will leach manganese out of the human body, stressing out the Borrelia organism. And it's just another way of approaching this, you know, kind of outsmarting this organism's ability to evade the human immune system. And one of the ways it does that is being using manganese, where other organism would use iron. So I'm really supportive of anything that improves the immune system in Lyme patients.
Good. Well, Ken, thank you for being on today. Hopefully people will read the book. It's an important contribution to their education on this subject, and we look forward to hearing from you again. Ken Stoller, S-T-O-L-L-E-R. And the name of your book again, Ken?
Incurable Me.
Incurable Me. Thanks for being with us. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. And remember, tonight, 7 p.m., a program you have not heard anywhere on the media, an exclusive, the one person in America who knows who is handling all the power and structure and the policy behind Hillary Clinton. Who's the puppet master? Wow. You want to tune in 7 o'clock, Progressive Radio Network, for that on Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.
Know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN underscore.